Hey, it's Jeff and Jeremy from the Ultra Running Guys. And if you're here, you probably already know that we started this podcast to help you take your next step in your ultra running journey.
But what you may not know is that in addition to this podcast, we also host two live races in the Wilmington, North Carolina area that are designed to do the same.
Yep, the first is the Hydra, which takes place on April 20th and has a 50K individual, a 50K relay, and a half marathon option. Whatever option you choose, we promise that slaying the Hydra will be unlike any race that you've ever experienced.
And the second is the Final Countdown, which takes place on September 14th. And whether you've never run before or you're a hardcore ultra veteran, this race is designed to help you find your limits. And we will be there with you to help celebrate.
All right, so mark your calendars, share with your friends, and visit us at our website, theultrarunningguys.com, or check out the links in the show notes for more info.
And with that, enjoy the episode, and remember, when in doubt, just show up.
And so I sat at this aid station almost all night, and it was kind of drizzling a lot of night. And I was sitting down inside of the big pop-up, and I would just sit next to runners with my camera and just talk. And while I'm talking to them, I'd be like, okay, click, click. You know, they forget I had a camera. And I kind of did that the rest of the race. And when Candace saw the pictures, she was like, oh my God, I had no idea this is what goes on at my races.
And welcome back to the Ultra Running Guys. You got Jeremy Reynolds and Jeff Winchester of the Ultra Running Guys. And the reason that we're here is to help you take your next step in your ultra running journey. And if you've been around, we appreciate you so much. The ask is the same. If you're finding the value, hit the like, do the follow, share with your friends, really tell them what you're putting in your ears. It means the world to us. And if you're new here, welcome. We hope you enjoy the show, but we're going to get right into it. So our guest tonight has become a household name in the sport, renowned for his ability to elegantly tell the stories of ultra running through the lens of his camera, capturing moments of joy, of agony, perseverance, and defeat, and nearly every emotion in between. But long before he first picked up his camera, he was conquering monster distances, which more often than not have been accompanied by mind-boggling elevation gain. His 25-year running resume boasts 10 finishes at the Hard Rock 100, 9 finishes at the Angeles Crest 100, and other staple ultras such as the Leadville 100, Wasatch 100, Tahoe 200, and many more. So stick around while we get to know the man behind the camera, hear how he is preparing to take on the Ouray 100 and the Swiss Alps 100 just 3 weeks apart in 2024, and what some of his favorite moments have been to capture with his lens. And with that, Howie Stern, welcome to the show.
Hey there. Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
Well, look, we're so excited to have you. We've been kind of communicating and glad this just all came together. And, you know, this is one of those things that when you put it together, you're like, there's so much we want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And we were just talking before we started rolling. It's interesting, especially with the sport growing and newer, people probably know you for your photography, just the incredible work that you put out. But as we've learned, you know, there was way more to Howie Stern prior to that. So we kind of want to get into your background. One of the things that we know is that you got into running to be better at alpine skiing. Tell us about, like, when did it become more than that for you?
Wow, you dug up my past.
You caught him off guard, right?
It did, yeah. I mean, I did do it to get better at skiing. And then I got into triathlon during college and started running trails from the get-go because they were right near my house, and running on the roads in the city, you had to deal with traffic lights, but the trails, you know, that's all we knew. Even when I was a triathlete, I wasn't super serious on the running end. Like, I was a good cyclist. I was definitely fast on a bike. I was a pretty decent swimmer, and the runs I kind of tolerated. Like, I think even when I was doing like half Ironman distance, I don't even remember what I did training for runs. I can't even remember the runs during the races. I couldn't tell you what the courses were like. I could tell you what the bike rides were like. Heck, even when I did an Ironman in 98, I don't remember the run at all. My only goal was, I don't want to walk at all in the marathon. And I probably ran the slowest fully running marathon you could ever run, which was so much worse than what my bike split was and what my run split or swim split was. But it was really, it was during that training for an Ironman in 98. And I was also a rock climber. And I had a climbing buddy who had a Western States license plate frame. And I remember asking him, I'm like, what's up with that? Western States 100. I haven't heard of that. He's like, oh, it's a 100-mile trail run from Squaw Valley to Auburn. And it still, it didn't really compute. But on the way home from climbing, we were in the Angeles National Forest in the San Gabriels down in California. He's like, oh, would you mind stopping at Shortcut Saddle on the way home? My friend is training for the Angeles Crest 100. And I said I would drop some water off for him. And I'm like, what's that? He's like, oh, it's this race from Wrightwood to Pasadena, all on single track, all through the mountains. And then I was like, okay, that sounds interesting. And I remember every time I would hike out of this climbing area called Williamson Rock, I would be like, what would it be like to run 100 miles in these mountains? And I grew up in those mountains. And I remember being a kid kind of in high school, as soon as I got my license, I would drive up to the mountains. I didn't know what trails or anything. And I would just park my car somewhere and just go straight up hillsides, just contemplating life, the universe and everything. And so there was a lot of personal history in those mountains. And really, while training for the Ironman in 98, that's when I said to myself, well, next year's project is Angeles Crest. And plus, like, training for triathlons was hard. I was like, well, instead of being mediocre at three things, let's be mediocre at one thing. and it coincided with me moving to the Sierra in the late 90s. And after that Ironman in 99, I was like, well, I need a qualifier to run Angeles Crest, which right down the road, I was living in Mammoth, was the Bishop High Sierra 50 mile. And I chose that as my qualifier. But really the reason I got really into the long distance stuff, besides wanting to do that race, was I absolutely hated backpacking. Because I hated carrying stuff, like, with a burning passion. And, you know, living in Mammoth, you know, I'm right by the John Muir Trail, the Pacific Crest Trail, insane backcountry. And people would, you know, back then, people were, you know, they'd go hike for a week with like a 70-pound backpack. I'm like, that's miserable. And I realized real quick, I'm like, just with a couple of water bottles, I can go cover 40 miles, be back in like eight and a half hours, home for dinner and sleep in my own bed, and basically have to carry nothing other than water and a little bit of food. This is way before hydration packs. So whatever I carried for food was either in a tiny fanny pack or just like in the little pocket on a water bottle. But running became a way for me to explore the Sierra since it was my new home. That was sort of the catch for me for running. And when I got serious about it, it was just a way to see the backcountry without carrying anything.
That's so cool, though. And it's funny because even when you're talking about the triathlon, and tell me if I'm right, but it's almost like when you were talking about running as a form of exercise or racing, it was like, right? Like, that's not my favorite part. But when it became about exploration and a way to get out and do a thing that you wanted to do quicker, then it was like, oh, well, this is much more enjoyable because it's about exploration versus how quick can I, you know, cover the course.
It kind of became about efficiency, like, because where I lived, every run was basically a backcountry run. You can drive all up and down the Owens Valley and just pick another part of the High Sierra that you want to run. And yeah, I'd be running up passes, you know, you'd go past people with these huge packs and they're looking at you, they're going, oh my God, how are you running up this? I'm like, well, I've got one water bottle. Like, I'm not carrying anything. I'm like, it's not hard. Granted, I was 29, you know, like, and before my back injury, I could run anything. Like I guess coming from triathlons, you know, or road running, you never walked. So I assume you're supposed to run everything. So I ran mountain passes as well. And, but it was just a beautiful, efficient way to see a lot of cool terrain. And the competitive side of me, I you know, when I was on a bike, I was insanely competitive. The 1 year I was training for that Ironman, they have a 100-mile bike ride in Mammoth. And I remember starting 20 minutes late, catching the lead pack somewhere around 20-something miles. And then they're all trying to draft on me. But because in triathlon, drafting is not allowed, I kept on riding faster and faster so they couldn't stay with me. And I wound up finishing first by like 20 minutes. It's something I've never done, been able to do running. Like I just, I'm not as talented on running, but I just also didn't have that same drive to, like, on a bike, I'd see somebody, I have to catch them. And when I was running, I'm like, I don't care. Yeah. You know, even in races nowadays, I will purposely put myself in between people. So I run alone so that I won't speed up if somebody's going to catch me, or sometimes I'll purposely slow down just to be in my bubble. But I think, like, kind of what you were saying, like with racing, I was like, I'm like, as an ultra runner, I either lived in the Sierra, and now I live in the San Juans. Like the two places I lived were so shockingly beautiful on their own. It's almost like no race could top the scenery of where I lived. So that was part of why I was never like super motivated to race all over the place constantly, like a lot of people, because I could just stay home and be in the backcountry by myself or with some friends in just ungodly beautiful wilderness. Of course, now living in Silverton, like I can run on the Hard Rock course. It's right behind my house. So
how did you end up getting to the starting line of Leadville then?
Yeah, so my first two attempts at Angeles Crest, which were 1999 and 2000, I didn't finish. A part of that was, you know, I was in the throes of a pretty radical eating disorder, and it made training a challenge. I think the first year not finishing, I made it like 53 miles or 52 miles. And part of it was just, you know, you got to go back to the 90s. You know, this is like mostly pre-internet, pre-everything. And I did my 50 miler in Bishop for my qualifier, and you're like, in your head, you're like, oh, I just ran 50 miles. How hard could it be just for another 50? Well, you know, you're done with a 50 miler in the daylight. And when I went to go run the 100 miler, it was such a different experience. And yeah, I got to a certain point where it was dark and you just start to get, you're feeling bad and you get overwhelmed and you're like, oh my God, like 47 more miles or 19 more hours. And like, I got tunnel visioned and couldn't comprehend. And then the next year I wound up having a better race. I trained more, and then I had like a foot injury during the race that I had to drop at 75 miles. And at the time I wasn't, you know, wasn't sure, should I drop, should I not? But I wound up stopping. And I think it was the following year in 2001 where I was like, well, maybe I should try another race. Maybe Angeles Crest is too difficult. So let's do Leadville. Granted, Angeles Crest had like probably a 60 something percent finisher rate, and Leadville had a 42% finisher rate. But I live at altitude, and elevation wise, Leadville was relatively flat compared to Angeles Crest. But me being me, I was signed up for both of them that year. And I was a teacher at the time, and my eating disorder was wickedly out of control. And I was doing no training during the school year because just, I was in a bad place. Mm-hmm. And I was teaching PE at the time, so at least I was kind of being active. But I remember like a couple of weeks before school ended, I sprained my ankle during PE, playing soccer with the kids. And I went through physical therapy, and I went and hiked Half Dome in a boot. And just because I had to get out. And I wound up hiking it really fast. And I was like, well, what am I going to do about Leadville? It's coming up and I haven't done anything. And I said, well, when the school year is over, let's take a drive to Leadville and see what it's like. I had never been there. And so it was like June 6th or something, and the race is in August. And so I drove to Leadville, and I wound up running 75 miles that week off the couch, and just was like, whatever it takes, I need to do this. I've got 10 weeks to get ready. And all I have to do is keep my eating disorder at bay for 10 weeks and I'll be good. And for those 10 weeks, yeah, that first 8 weeks, I probably averaged 75 to 85 miles a week. Every 10 days was doing a 35 to 40 mile run in the backcountry up to 12 plus thousand feet. And I had my few relapses with massively uncontrolled eating. And then I'd go run at midnight and do a 16 miler on the Mammoth Scenic Loop and on 395, just so that I wouldn't. I never used running as punishment, but a few times while training for that, I did use it to offset when I messed up. Yeah, I showed up in Leadville, probably the fittest I've ever been in my life. Like, yeah, when you're young, you can go from off the couch and train your ass off in 10 weeks and be like, my taper run at 10,000 feet was at 7:30 pace. Like, it was nothing. Like, I was just fit. Oddly enough, it's still my 100-mile PR. And, you know, there's what, 600 people running that race. And I was having a great day. I got to the turnaround in just over 10 hours. I should have run a 22-hour race. My friend who was near me did, but I eventually caved, and this crushed me so hard going up the power line that I had a world-class bonk by the time I hit the top, and it started to snow at the top, and I just got cold and lost all my energy, and it took so long eventually to get down to May Queen, and then I was in a sleeping bag for 45 minutes at May Queen until my dad was finally like, okay, Hal, you should get up. It's time to go finish. And I got up and then I started to run again. And I finished in 25 and change. It was still dark. But I instantly collapsed at the finish and started to cry because I couldn't believe it. I finally did it. I finally ran 100 miles. And, you know, and back then, like, everybody thought it was ludicrous. Mm-hmm. You know, why would you run 100 miles? Like, that's bad for you. You know, my parents are like, "How? Like, you've lost your mind. Why are you doing this?" You know, nobody thought it was possible. And especially coming from like this 4 year long eating disorder that almost killed me mentally. Well, I mean, yeah, there were a lot of days I wished I'd never woke up. For whatever reason, the second I crossed the finish line, it all ended. And that was the last day. It was like August 19th, 2001 was the last day I ever had an eating disorder. And I don't know why it went away. Maybe somehow in my own mind, I finally proved to myself I could do something really hard that I set my mind to. And I felt my own internal worth instead of looking for worth from other people or from my parents. I can't explain it. I just know that I went through 4 years of hell leading up to it. And as soon as I finished that race, that was the end of it. And then 6 weeks later, I finished the Angeles Crest 100 for the first time.
I think it's huge. And I think you sharing about having an eating disorder and having it for 4 years and then crossing the finish line. And I do think that you were instilled with a sense of personal worth that gave you a sense of confidence, but also that you can control you and not be out of control, probably like you experienced going into it. And so I think it's been a huge life-changing event for you. And I mean, it showed itself up 6 weeks later when you finished the next 100 mile, that it kind of just, it was like a stamp of confirmation almost for you, of even where you had been. Like, that's huge. And so I'm grateful that you would share it.
I'm an open book with that stuff. And not many people, like, usually people associate eating disorders, you know, with women, and they don't realize that, like, there's tons of males out there who deal with it. And mine started when I was a rock climber. It started innocently enough by a girlfriend saying, "Oh, if you follow this diet, maybe you'll climb better." And it was back when the zone diet first came out and the whole 40-30-30. And, you know, you go from like eating normal to all of a sudden you're measuring everything you eat. And yeah, I went down to like 3% body fat, and I could climb awesome, but I had no energy ever outside of when I was actually on the rock. And at the end of a climbing trip one day, my friends, when we were at the Owens River Gorge in Bishop, we were going to head back to LA, and they're like, oh, you want to stop for some ice cream? I'm like, nah, I don't want any ice cream. I'm not eating like sugary stuff like that. But then I caved. They said, yeah, you know what? I haven't had a treat in like a long time. And I had ice cream and I felt this massive rush from all the sugar. And then you start having ice cream with every meal, and then it becomes, it led into this going 180 degrees the other direction where I couldn't stop. I'd eat four bowls of cereal in the morning and I couldn't stop myself. And then I'd go like for weeks uncontrolled. I wasn't purging. I never used exercise for punishment. So I just like suffered. But then I'd go for 3 weeks, flip the other way, eat perfectly. And then as soon as I started to feel good, I would eat like garbage for 4 weeks. And it was this repeating cycle for 4 years. And, you know, like it's what led me to move to the Sierra. Cause at the time when I first started, I was an engineer in LA. I went through a divorce and a rocky relationship, and I was miserable, and I didn't care if a bus hit me. Yeah, I'll be God's honest truth. The only reason I'm still here is cause I knew ultimately I would never do something to myself, because if I did it, it would destroy my parents, and I couldn't put them through that, but I sure didn't want to live. It was that bad. And at some point in May or June of 98, I remember I was so bad where I went, you know, I'm at the point where I can't keep doing what I'm doing with work. And if I'm going to throw it all away and be homeless, why not go somewhere beautiful and just start over and see what happens? And then I remembered, because I used to ski race in Mammoth. I'm like, dude, you always wanted to live in Mammoth. Why not just go move to Mammoth and see what happens? And that was my temporary way of trying to, like I said, maybe if I remove myself from the hell situation I was in, I'll do better. But, you know, like they say, no matter where you go, that's where you are. Right. And it took, a couple more years until I moved to Mammoth in 98, and it was 2001 when I finally, you know, got over it in that summer finishing the race. Yeah, even during like the second race that year, Angeles Crest, I wanted to quit it halfway because I'm like, I've already done 100 once. Why am I doing this? This is stupid. Like, yeah, I don't need to do this. And just somebody at the aid station, he's like, man, look at you. You're doing great. You're ahead of like most of the field. Like, you have no reason to stop. And it was just hearing somebody who actually had confidence in me. I was like, you're right. And I got up and, oh God, it sucked. And it was a struggle, but I did it. And, you know, I remember though, when I did that last 26, I remember crying a couple times during it because it just never ended. And everybody who's ever done Angeles Crest will attest to that last 26 is a special place in hell. And I've said this at Hard Rock to numerous pacers who have run Angeles Crest. I'm like, even though the climbs are way bigger, the last, you know, 20 miles of Hard Rock, I'm like, this is way easier than the last 26 miles of Angeles Crest.
So interesting. I mean, a couple things. One, just want to thank you again for being open about your story. I'm sure that I think we can all relate that everybody's got their version of something, right? And it sounds like yours is pretty extreme, you know, for a while. But also it sounds like that there's a part of ultra running that we have all grown to love that may have literally, you know, helped save your life at the time. And so I appreciate you sharing that with us. I also find it super fascinating that you cross the finish line. That is the end. Like, you don't hear that kind of story very often, but my guess is there was a big internal transition that had been happening that kind of culminated.
Yeah. You know, and maybe I've tried to think about what it was, but thinking about it now, maybe, you know, I've been playing music since I was 7, and then in middle school took up drums, and then year later in high school took up guitar, and at 16 I was already playing in Hollywood clubs with my bands. But my dad, you know, he was an accountant, he always had the thing, you know, be an accountant, you'll always make a living, you know. And my first gig ever was at the Whiskey. You know, I mean, Van Halen's played there, The Who has played there, The Doors, you know, you name it. And I was so shy as a kid, but you put a guitar on me and I'll get on stage in front of a packed place and I'm in my world. But all my dad could say after the gig is like, is this what you want to do with your life? Look at all these long hair freaks. And I'm like, like, yeah, your quiet kid will get on a stage full of people. And that's like where my thing is. And maybe it was because growing up, not that I was controlled, but in a sense I was, it's like, you're going to go to school, you're going to go to college, you have to do this. Have a girlfriend, get married, have kids, you have to do this. And like my whole life, it's like I had been living for other people. Rock climbing is something I picked up on my own. And the running, the trail running, I had just picked up on my own. And again, like people telling you 100 miles is stupid. Like, why would you want to run that? But I think finishing the race, maybe it was finally something I did 100% for myself. There was nobody saying, oh, you should run 100 miles. You should do this, or you're doing this wrong. Like probably the first time in my life I got to do something. Yeah. Where maybe I was truly in control. I don't know if in control, I wouldn't even say like control, but I did something for myself that I wanted to do that I was passionate about. You know, I was finally successful at it.
And you kind of took it by storm, right? Because we talked about you had already taken two attempts at Angeles Crest. So you finished Leadville in 2001, Angeles Crest in 2001. If I go look at your ultra sign up, there's 65 events on there. And that doesn't even include, I'm sure, several others that don't make it on ultra sign up. You have done so much. We mentioned some in the intros. You've been at Barkley. You've been on the Badwater course. So all these things. Now, is there one or two that stands out as the most memorable? Obviously, we just talked about a memorable experience, but as far as the race itself, you know, what stands out and why?
There's probably two of them. The short one was probably when I ran like 4:28 at a 50K. That was sort of uncharted territory for me. Most all my 50Ks were in the 5-something hour range, but that race, the universe made it so I didn't have to ever let off the gas pedal. Like, it was super fun to run hard from start to finish in a race and slowly catch people. And then when you'd see somebody from behind, you're trying to just not let people catch you. And that was a cool experience. That hasn't happened too often where I feel like I'm actually racing, you know. But I was always kept humble because as good as my race went, well, Hal Corner was still in the race and he still beat me. He still beat me by just under an hour. I was in 10th place. So it was top 10, but like still like the true elites, Hal and Oswaldo, you know, they were still like so far ahead of me.
It's fun to have a good day though.
But it was awesome to have a good day and not have a low point. I think it might be one of the few races I've ever had where there was no low point. It was just like, yeah, there were parts that were hard and sucked because it was hot, but you were still able to keep like pushing. And then other than that, every Hard Rock is special for different reasons, but I feel like the 2013 Hard Rock was kind of super special because the first two finishes were kind of deep into the second night. My third and fourth finish were right at the cusp of when night begins. Like I finished in the 9-something o'clock range. I forced myself to not use my headlight on finish number 4, but it was definitely dark. But it's always been like a almost like the sub 24 at States and other places. Finishing Hard Rock in the daylight is like a big thing. You almost wish there was a separate buckle for it or something. You felt like you kind of crossed into a different level when you finished a daylight finish. And there were a couple of years I didn't get into the race because, you know, so even then it was hard to get into. And I paced my friend Billy Simpson in 2011. And Billy was always between like, you know, 33, 34, 35 hour finisher. And I paced him for 62 miles that year. And I learned so much from pacing Billy, seeing what a fast person does, where he doesn't waste time and where he's, you know, hiking versus running. And I went, okay, I was able to do Billy's pace for 2/3 of Hard Rock. I think I can do this the next time I get in. And it wound up being 2 years later in 2013, I got in the race. It was also going to be for my 5th finish, which put me into the veteran category. Like some of the key things I remember, my friend Katie was pacing me. Katie, well, she was Katie DeSplinter back then, but now she's Katie Grossman, Dom Grossman's wife. Well, I remember going up Grant Swamp Pass and I was alone. Like I ran most of that race alone. I don't know where the rest of the field was. I know there were still people in front of me, probably 20 people in front of me. And she wound up taking a cell phone pic of me that became the poster for the next year. There's just going up Grant Swamp. There's, you can't see anybody. You never, usually you don't run Hard Rock by yourself. There's people around, but now you're at 13,000. You're looking back going, there's nobody. I'm like, this is weird. And at the next aid station, I caught this guy, Greg Hartman, and he was also going for his 5th. And he's like, oh man, we're going to be like 39, 40 hours. I'm like, look at my watch. I'm like, dude, are you kidding me? I'm like, no way. We're going to be sub 38. Like we'll be like 37, like for sure. He's like, nah, no way. I'm like, dude, trust me. Like, let's get out of here. Let's go. And so we kind of worked with each other and pushed each other up the final 2 climbs in and out of the rain. And I was exhausted. Like my climbing sucked, but I couldn't keep up with him on the downhill. He just had better downhill legs. And I remember coming off the last pass in this golden light, but with like the rain that falls, but it doesn't hit the ground. I can't remember the term for it.
Mist.
But you're seeing, it's not mist. No, there's a very specific term because you see it falling from the clouds, but it's actually not quite hitting the ground, and there's rainbows in it. And I'm looking at my watch going, this is the Hard Rock I've always dreamed of having. Like I'm going to have like the super solid daylight finish. I just felt like I was in a different world. Like I was getting closer to the people that you looked up to when you did the race all those other times. You're like, how do you finish in those times? And now you're like, this is happening. This is real. And I remember coming down the Shrine Road. There was a double rainbow over Kendall Mountain as we were coming down. I was running just so hard down the Shrine Road, just going, man, if I kick a rock, like I'm going to be taken away in an ambulance. And it was so cool running down Snowden towards the high school and you start to see all your friends. Yeah. And I finished in 37, my time was sequential. It was 37 hours, 38 minutes and 39 seconds.
Wow.
It meant a lot for like, it was a time I just didn't know that I was possible for me to run. I was so excited to get it. And it was only 7:30 at night. All the restaurants are still open. All my friends are there. And it was my 5th finish. So I got into the vet category, which meant I didn't have to deal with the hard lottery anymore.
So I'm just going to jump in for a second. Listening to you, right? It's amazing to me because obviously we know you as an incredible photographer of ultra running events and everything. And you have this ability to capture people's moments and experiences that they have that they could not have actually seen themselves because you've taken a picture of them, right? But when you talk about your personal experiences as a runner, you have this incredible gift of retention to where you are actually putting yourself in those races that you experienced all the way back in 2001, 1998, as a triathlete as well. Like you have this ability to put yourself back in that moment that I'm thinking of all the races I've done that I can't do.
Right,
and it's like somehow you have taken, right? Like somehow you have taken almost a picture of them yourself, of those experiences, and you are able to tap into not only to what you saw, but what you felt.
Yeah.
And that is huge. And I don't know if you spend time reflecting on those experiences in such a way, like when you go out and on runs and stuff, and you look back at them, like, I don't know how you do that retention that you're able to do, but it is something that you do as a photographer, but also as an individual that you're able to pull from your own, like, set of emotions. It's impressive to me.
Well, that means the world. No, thank you so much. If you look at my ultra sign up, you know, it'll be almost 25 years. I only have 60 something races. Most people probably have like 200 races in that stretch. Like I didn't ever race that much, but most of the time when I did race, like with 100 miles especially, like I finished 21, but 19 of them are of two races, because I gravitated towards stuff that like meant something deep in my heart. And like with hard rock, I guess it killed me when I hear people talk of hard rock, like, oh, that's a bucket list race for me. When for most of the people that were doing hard rock years ago, at least a lot of the ones that were repeat runners, like that race took over our lives in a sense. It's what we looked forward to. Like you got a grace period of a week after the race, and then you're like, I can't wait till next year. So when I was running hard rock, I could probably write a race report for all 10 finishes to this day, because every part of that course, the people that were out there, all the things just became so imprinted on your heart and brain. You remember it all. I can make myself cry easily. You saw me a minute ago. I almost cried as I was describing coming into the finish. Like I even made Dale cry my first finish, because the way I was crying at the finish line, and he even recited that in his story at the awards the next day. I don't know, that there's just something about that race and a few other key ones. They just so imprinted on me. It's almost like it's like this time and place that just gets cemented. And I don't know, it's almost the longer you're in it, it gets hard, because these earlier experiences are so ingrained in you, and it's easy to get jaded and go, ah, it's so different now. But then remembering like, oh, all the people that are new to the sport, now they're getting those same feelings that you had, you know, 25 years ago, 20 years ago, 15 years ago. It's like, it just keeps perpetuating. But for some reason, certain things just imprint really hard on me.
It's fascinating. Yeah. So I caught some of, you know, you with Ethan, the Ginger Runner, and there's you guys are talking about the 2018 Hard Rock, which is your 10th finish. And even that, talking about, I think you told a story about your first one and you got emotional there too. And I was like, okay, wow, this guy can really connect. And my first thought was like, oh, this is why. Cause to me, when I look at your photos, like you were so good at catching the emotion of the moment, right? It's not just action. It's not just things happening, but you can like tell a story of emotion with it. And then when you also talk about what you see, like the San Juans, what you love about them, the beauty, it's like something comes out of you that, like you said, I think the imprint, but it's really cool to witness. I do want to know though, cause you mentioned like, obviously that's a place for you. You live in Silverton now. And so for everybody that's listening, I won't say that, you know, for their bucket list race, right? But if they haven't, like us, have not been there, I've read all kinds of things. I've watched all kinds of things about Hard Rock. We had Dale Girl on the show. He talked about just some of the scenery and different things. But when you think about that race and somebody who's never seen it, like, how do you describe it? What is it that draws you to that part of the country?
What I tell everybody, what's one of the unique things about Hard Rock, so there's 12 passes and a peak. Every single time you come into a new basin after the pass, it looks different than where you just came from. So it's not like most races where you're just kind of in a general type of scenery. It might change a little bit. The Hard Rock, it's just, it never looks the same. It looks different everywhere you go. And then you'll be shocked at how much water you pass through. Like you'll have feet wet for like the whole race, and there's creeks everywhere and snow. And the very first climb, unbelievable wildflowers of crazy colors lining the trail at 12 to 13,000 feet. And you come over this ridge and you're on this little saddle at Little Giant, and it's a hanging valley where that the glaciers have scooped out, and you're looking like 3,000 foot vertical in a very steep relief It's like you're in an airplane looking down because like the it's so deep down in Cunningham Gulch and you're so high above it. You're just almost dumbfounded going like, how is this real? Like, wow, this is the first climb. And then you're on the second climb and you're going up this insanely steep green slope. And it was, I think they had just recently put in the race and there's like no trail going over it. And I'm just laughing going like, who would put a race on in a place like this? Like you're just on a tundra slope with no trail. What is this? And there's huge peaks in the background and again, wildflowers. And then you drop off of that and now you're in some weird volcanic thing. And then you're going up to another high ridge and you're just like, oh my God, there's like these insane views and more wildflowers. And then next thing you know it, you're on top of a 14,000 foot peak after meandering through snow for a mile and running down in these insanely beautiful basins. And Jesus, you go up to Virginia's Pass, you're climbing up a steep snowfield, pulling on a rope, going to an aid station at 13,000 feet on a knife edge ridge while a guy in a poncho and a sombrero offers you tequila. You're like, what is going on? Yeah, it's just that. And then getting over the top and going up to Joel's Monument and putting a little rock and then seeing Adam Lake for the first time. I mean, it'll bring tears to your eyes. I've had my pacer, one year my pacer, Dennis Williams, he had never been on that part of the course. He cried his eyes out when he saw Island Lake for the first time. It's just, there's so much insane beauty in these mountains. There's nothing else like it in the States. Nowhere. There's pretty places. And even coming from the High Sierra, which I'll put against any mountain range in the world, like, there is nothing like the Hard Rock course. Even Killian says the most beautiful 100-miler in the world. Like it lives up to the hype. The course is insane. Even when you feel like utter shit and crap, you look around, oh, look at the pretty wildflowers. Look at that. Look at that. Like you still know you can still get joy by seeing the insane beauty that's all around you. And even to this day, after living here for 10 years, there's still places I go where I'm like, how is this real? It doesn't change. And that's why I tell people, whether or not you're in Hard Rock or not, come out, pace somebody, volunteer, come hike around before the race. Like, that's why it's not a bucket list race. Hard Rock is an event. It's a happening. It's like a whole thing. It's not just the race. It's just being here and experiencing it and taking it all in. And, you know, and I believe in lottery karma. If you put some time in out here and you absorb it into your soul, like, the lottery gods will smile on you eventually.
You can tell it truly touches you.
It does. And I know you're saying it's not a bucket list race and it shouldn't be, but you have basically tried to convince everybody it needs to be a race they need to experience. So just so you know, you're creating this problem.
Well, you know what? That's part of our job almost as vets is to like spread that love and joy of Hard Rock and, you know, get people to come out and experience it for themselves. You don't have to watch it necessarily on a live stream or on a, like, you can follow it in other ways, but man, there's nothing like being in Silverton, in your raid, in Telluride. To actually get your feet on the ground out here, even if you're not in the race. All the years that I didn't get into the race, I would pace for 58 miles. And you're still part of, you feel every bit as part of it in the race when you're on the course for 28 hours with somebody and you feel just as good running into Silverton as you do when you have a number on. At least that's how I felt.
It definitely sounds like the kind of thing that like we just have to prioritize getting out there and experience, even if it's not the race itself, like you said, volunteering, pacing, something. And the more you talk about it, and like I said, we had Dale Garland. So for everybody listening, obviously, I'm sure you're familiar with Hard Rock, but we talked with Dale. He gave the kind of the origin of the race and everything. And to hear him talk about the passion behind it, that's episode 41. So go check it out if you haven't already. But I don't know. Hard Rock just seems so iconic.
Like a bucket race?
What's that?
Like a bucket race. Like a bucket
race. But I'll say it. But like you said, to you, it's more than that. 10 finishes. That said, you know, kind of looking forward, you've got a couple big things on the calendar. And I'm kind of fast forwarding a little bit because obviously we want to get to the photography and some of the other stuff. But you got a big year for yourself. So your two A races, your A100, which happens to be on July 21st. And then you've also got 3 weeks later, the Swiss Alps 100, which looks like it is another 33K of elevation. So you're a 41,000 feet of elevation out your back door. And then the Swiss Alps, I'm sure, has to be beautiful. But one thing that really stands out about these two things is they are similar to Hard Rock, just massive elevation gain. And listening to you talk, the question I had is, what about the elevation attracts you? But my guess is it's probably more about the
view,
the scenery and the experience and that. And it just happens, those things come with elevation.
Yeah, that, I mean, that really honestly is it. You know, like maybe when I was younger, you're like, oh, harder is better. And now as you get older, just like harder is hard. Pretty hard. Well, Ure is just down the road. And my friend puts it on. But the first time I went to do it was not the year to do it, because that's when I had my cancer and had my thyroid and 7 lymph nodes removed in April of that year. The bummer of not finishing the first year was, guess who my pacer was supposed to be for the last 25 miles? Walmsley.
Oh, was it really?
He was going to pace me the last 25 miles. And I remember when he agreed to do it, I was going to like, you realize you're going to go the slowest you've ever gone in your life. And he's like, well, you know, he's like, I just want to get a lot of time on my feet for UTMB. I'm like, well, you are going to get a lot of time on your feet. And he wound up actually pacing my friend Billy, who was doing the 50 mile after I had dropped. And he did get a lot of time on his feet. Anyway, long story short, yeah, I wound up dropping from that race at 44 miles because I hadn't had the training. And then the following year, Charles was like, here, you should do Ure again. Here's a link. Except last year it was, you know, it was the week after Hard Rock. I was like, sure, why not? Let's do them back to back. And I had but I felt better than I ever felt at Ure last year. But I wound up actually having a foot issue that crept up that I could barely admit, from being able to go normal to like, I can't even walk because like putting pressure on it were killing me. But in hindsight, I hated dropping and I'm mad at myself for it, but it is what it is. So yeah, I'm back. It's almost like the Angeles Crest thing. Hopefully third time will be a charm. And my friend puts on the Swiss Alps and he's like, oh, you should come out to do Swiss Alps. I'm like, I would love to. I've never raced in Europe. That's kind of why I want to do Swiss Alps. It's a friend's race. It looks gorgeous. Plus Courtney's husband, Kevin, did it last year and you know, we're all good friends. And Kevin was telling me how wonderful it is. And I'm like, that sounds like fun. I'm not even worried that they're 3 weeks apart. I've done the Hard Rock Angeles Crest double numerous times, and they're only 2 to 3 weeks apart. But to me, it's training. You train for Ure, and then you recover, and then you do the other one. It's like 10,000 feet less of climb.
Yeah. Oh, it'll be easy.
Oh, it's only like 33,000 feet, I think.
And it's lower. It's like lower elevation.
Oh. You mean lower elevation and lower altitude, or just
lower altitude?
Yeah, lower altitude. Yeah. And on the bright side, now that Walmsley's back in the States, he can pace you again for Ure.
If he would want to, I would love. I told myself I don't want pacers this year. It's weird now. I'm kind of going into a mode where I find I do best by myself when I'm suffering, and somehow when I'm with other people, I find it too easy to like lose focus of what I need to do. I haven't finished 100 milers since 2018. So hopefully this year, I'm not going to say hopefully, because my friend used to say, hope is not a strategy. Like, no, I'm going to train my ass off this year and be as fit as I can.
Even though we've done research, there's still things coming out. I didn't realize some of the health struggles that you'd had in the last couple of years. And so it's interesting now to see that perspective as you're gearing up for a pretty darn big year. And that's going to be really fun to follow, by the way. So if everybody listens, you know, check out those two races. But I know we're running a little bit late on time. We definitely want to touch on the photography. And so I'm going to kind of transition us there. Again, we talked about before the show, we started Ultras in 2016. You picked up the camera in 2015. But as far as I was concerned, there was always Howie Stern taking photos and ultra running, because that's how I came to know you, right? It was these amazing photos that you'd see, like I said, capturing the emotion and stuff. How did that come about? And I'm assuming that ultra running was just kind of a natural niche, but how did you end up picking the camera and then turning into the Howie that we know now?
It was very random. When I went out to Hard Rock in 2014, like 2014 was my best running year ever. Cause like when you go through divorce, you take all your energy and anger and hate, and you transfer it into something else. For me, it was running. I ran that 428 50K that year. I ran my 36 hour Hard Rock PR that year. I ran Angeles Crest that year. I ran Wasatch that year. Like it was an insane year. But when I went to Silverton, my friend who owned the Avon Hotel, he owned a house across the street, and he's like, well, if you want to live in my house after the race, just pay the utilities and you could live there as long as you want.
I need a friend like that, right?
Yeah, it was awesome. Man. And I moved to Silverton in August of that year. And my goal was, I'm like, I want to get back to music stuff. I'm going to set up a recording studio and I want to record an album. It bugged me. I've played my whole life and I don't have like a body of work. Well, 5 months go by and I was such the perfectionist that every time I'd record something, the next day I'd go like, no, that sucks. I hate it. Start over. Day after day after day. And 5 months goes by and you're like, okay, what am I going to do? I'm 44. I don't want to go back to teaching. And all I thought was, because I had my two dogs with me, Joey and Mickey, I'm like, I can't go back to a regular job. I cannot leave them alone for 8 or 9 hours a day. I have to do something so my dogs can be with me 24 hours a day. And in the fall of 2014, I had never been in the fall in Colorado, and it blew my mind the way the aspen trees were changing colors. And I'm taking a million iPhone pictures and posting them, and people kind of liked my pictures. And I'm like, I need to get a camera. At some point, when I finally got a camera and I had a couple friends that kind of shot running, and I went, I should start shooting races. I'm like, I've run ultras for 15 years. I know what it's like as a runner. Let's see what I can, if I can bring that to a camera. And yeah, March 2015 was the first race I ever shot. And yeah, I try not to cry, but like I had a good friend in LA. His name was Ivan Buzik. He was a photographer and he was also an ultra runner. He ran his first Angeles Crest when he was like 56 in 1999. But he came out to that race and he's like, here, I'll show you how to do it. And I have my little dinky, you know, cheap Nikon camera and kit lens. And he's like, take a look at this. And he has this camera. And he pushes the shutter and he just sounds like a machine gun. And he passed away last March. This is his camera. His son gave me that camera that he showed me that day, that he shot with that day. And I can't believe that I have it. It trips me out because it's like I can look through it and think like, no, that's what his eyes saw. And he was the guy that really got me excited and taught me how to do it is what I started doing. But somewhere along the line, like I got to be good friends with Candace Burt. And later that year, she was putting on the first edition of the Bigfoot 200. She asked if I wanted to shoot it. And I was like, of course. And prior to that, like, all I ever knew about shooting running was like people take pretty running pictures. It was always the big, oh, here's a pretty backdrop and let's get them running in the pretty backdrop. That was sort of like what everybody did. And for Bigfoot, all I knew was 108 hour cutoff. And I started out shooting the pretty running shots the first day and got some cool shots with Mount St. Helens. Like, I'm like, wow, this is awesome. And then somewhere on the second day, I remember being at an aid station, and on the ground, there's a little plaque in the ground that says, you know, Spencer Butte, mile like 101 point something. To that point, I had run a bunch of 100-mile races, and 200s, there's only been like the Tahoe 200. There's like, nobody is doing 200s then. And I'm just sitting there going, 101 and a half miles. Oh, these poor bastards are only halfway done. Like, you know, I got my mind on 100 miles, but like, wait, there's still a whole other half of the race. And so I sat at this aid station almost all night, and it was kind of drizzling a lot of night. And I was sitting down inside of the big pop-up, and I would just sit next to runners with my camera and just talk. And while I'm talking to them, I'd be like, okay, click, click. You know, they forget I had a camera. And I kind of did that the rest of the race. And when Candace saw the pictures, she was like, oh my God, I had no idea this is what goes on at my races. You know, you're just used to people running. But it's like, no, this is like the first time. It's sort of, I'm not going to say I started anything, but it's like people to that point, again, were like mostly shooting the pretty running shot. And I feel like I brought to the game trying to tell the story of the long race. You know, there's pretty running, but there's a lot of pain caves. There's a lot of struggle. A lot of dark times, a lot of fun times, there's volunteers, all the stuff that was going on. I slept 5 hours in the 108 hours of the race. There was just so much to shoot. That became my niche, my forte of just, I wasn't as excited at the time to shoot the trail stuff as I was to like, no, I can't wait till the later days in the race when I can just sit down and get to know people and try to capture something in them. And yeah, the first handful of years were really hard because I lived in my truck for almost 4 years with my two dogs. And it's honest truth, the number one reason I wanted to get good was so that I never had to leave my dogs. I'm like, I don't want to go back to a regular job. So I want to stay with my dogs, I better get good at this.
Well, you sure did. And those pictures have been, I don't know. That's what I think of when I think about the 200 mile races, right? Are just the emotions. A lot of times you have even the side-by-sides that a lot of people will do. Hey, here's me early in the race. And you know, here's
the before and afters.
Yeah. And it's like that to me is like the first time you can really see kind of what you're talking about, right? This transformation that happens to a runner over this time. And it's so fascinating. And, you know, one of the questions and we sent it to you, right? Of all the things you've seen, like what are some of the moments that stand out? Before I lose the opportunity though, because two of them have happened very recently, how much has Tara Dower become like an absolute favorite? I'm sure you're like, oh, sweet, Tara's here. This is going to be this is going to be a good day.
Well, like, I mean, first off, Tara's just an awesome person. Like some people you just feel an energy with, like she's just really sweet and nice. And she's friends with a lot of my other friends. So like, you're just like some people you're happy when you see on the trail or you see at the start or the finish or before or after whatever, like Tara's just a really awesome person. And when I shot her at Run Rabbit a couple of years ago, I didn't really know her. She finished second that year. I remember getting a couple of good finish line shots of her because you can tell she put it all out there. But really, the recent Tara stuff was, I was in shooting Javelina. I don't even know if I realized she was in the race. Cause like when people are coming by, like I'm looking through a viewfinder. I don't know. I can't always really see who's in front of me. But somebody at Jackass Junction was like, you need to go into the medical tent. Tara's in there. And then I walked in there and it's like, I started laughing and I was like, Tara, I'm not laughing at you. Well, I am, but I'm only laughing because I've had the same thing happen to me out here, and I know how fucking horrible it is.
And for everybody listening, if you're not familiar, if you haven't seen the picture, go check out Howie's Instagram. But essentially, she's got cactus all stuck in her. She's sitting on a bench, kind of, you know, giving you the sign, making a face. You got pictures of them removing those, like everything that went through it, right? But she looked like such a good sport during it.
Oh, she was. Like, I was so hoping they were going to make that the cover of Ultra Running, where she was flipping the devil horns with the cactus all over her. But they did make it the table of contents where they're pulling it out and she's like visibly like in pain. She is really tough. Like, I cannot describe how much it hurts when they pull it, because it has barbs on it. Like, and you'll have like 100 of these spines in your arm. And when you pull it, you watch your skin completely pull up. And you usually take a fork or something and you just rip it off and then watch the blood come out. So she was an awesome sport. And unfortunately, she didn't finish that race. And then, yeah, when she was in Black Canyon last weekend, every time I saw her on the course, she was happy and blood free. And then when I saw her at the finish line, you know, the finish line was chaotic. I was mainly shooting like the podiums for the golden tickets. And then I see Tara come like rushing in. The actual finish line shot of her sucked because it's just like, oh my God, there's Tara. Like, and the light was, it was already dark. But she like collapses into her friend's arms. And at first they're all hugging and happy. And then all of a sudden she just kind of gets a look of like, she's going down. And next thing you know, she's like on the ground. And then she finally comes back up. And now she's like, she's got skin hanging off of her arm and blood over here, her legs. And I'm just like, oh, you're the best. Like,
you make my job. Tough as nails.
Makes my job fun. And then she went to the med tent and got some more pictures. She threw up in there. She was getting cleaned up. She had to get a whole bunch of stitches and urgent care the next day. And she's racing Hard Rock this summer. Mm-hmm. I told her there's no cactus. There's rocks.
I said plenty of places to fall, though.
Right? And I will make sure to be on the face of Grand Swamp Pass going down towards Chapman when she's running down it. I know she'll fall. I fall. Everyone falls. No, but she's just an awesome person. And I honestly, like, the more I shoot, the more I just enjoy shooting people that I like naturally get along with. It's just like, I love to shoot Courtney. Like, we're really good friends. So shooting her is a blast. Francois is fun to shoot. Cause like, again, you have a connection. And sometimes, yeah, you shoot something like Cocodona, it's 250 miles. It's a lot of days. You can take people you didn't know at the start. By the time the race is over, like, you feel like you really know them.
Well, that's just it. I think the way you take the pictures, it's like you bring their personality out. You almost allow the viewer of the picture to kind of get to know a part of them, which is, I mean, I don't know how you do it because I'm nowhere near skilled to something like that. I'm an iPhone carrier and I'm like, oh, let me take a selfie, right? But you can literally do that and you can see who that person is by the way you take the picture of them. It's a great skill. Oh, it's an incredible skill.
I am my own worst critic. I almost hate everything that I shoot. And like, there's times where I put off editing forever because it's almost like if you're not inherently happy with something, you just don't want to look at it.
Yeah.
Everybody else might be like, oh, those are amazing. Like, in my own head, like, I have ideas of what I want to capture before I shoot something. And if they don't go the way I was hoping, then I get bummed out. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I have to get over myself a lot and just go, no, like, do your thing and it'll be fine. Cause like, as much as I want everyone else to like what I do, like, I'm the first customer. Like, I want to believe in what I'm shooting and be proud of what I'm putting out there. And so, but any photographer would tell you, yeah, you don't get portfolio shots every single time you shoot. It's just impossible. But, right. And you can't predict moments, which leads into like really the only time I've ever been shooting where you're like, holy shit, what the fuck is going on? Barclay 2017. Mm-hmm. Laying on the ground underneath the chair that finisher John Kelly is sitting on, seeing Gary on the ground gasping for air, trying to tell his story. That was the most surreal moment I've ever had shooting, you know, because everything else, people run fast races, you know, I've been there when Jim has run 1408 or 1409, you know, 1430, and seeing Courtney break course records. But like when you're at Barkley and you see one, you've already seen a finisher and you're all facing this way going, he's going to come off of Bird Mountain anytime now. He's got a half hour. And as time is ticking down, suddenly you're like, he's coming from that way. Wait, what is happening? And it had nothing to do, like nobody was paying attention to like the clock ticking, and it didn't matter that he was 6 seconds over, that was immaterial. But you just like, everybody was like, wait, where did you just come from? How are you coming from the wrong direction? And him trying to, you know, running for his life and then being on the ground, trying to explain. And it was just this moment that time stood still. The entire outside world disappeared. I don't almost even remember shooting. Like I remember looking, it was like watching a movie through a viewfinder. And the only time I consciously thought of shooting was, and really I was standing up and I'm like, oh, I should get on the ground. And you can watch Ethan's video and see me on the ground under the chair.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted to put those pictures in a book or print them out big. Like I have some really cool stuff from that, but I feel like deserves to be seen because they're just powerful images between with him and his wife.
We had Laz on recently, and that moment got referenced. And for everybody listening, if you're not familiar with the Where Dreams Go to Die, that moment is captured. So obviously you can hear it, but go watch it. And it's so fascinating to see. So to know that you had a front row seat.
Mm-hmm. And I wound up seeing it when he went on his tour, and that was crazy to watch it on a big screen and then, you know, hang out with Gary and Denise and after. And
so I would be remiss if I didn't ask you a question that I think is probably one of the most frustrating topics for photographers. And so I need to ask it because if I don't, everybody who knows me will like, why don't you just ask? What is your take on people who take a picture that you have and they put a little camera on social media and say it's photo credit to Howie Stern? Is that acceptable?
Assuming they've screenshotted it?
I don't know how they got it because it just flies on social media. Like, what's the rule of thumb if there is even one?
The protocol.
Because it happens all the time. And I know you know that.
Well, it depends what you're talking about. Like somebody bought the picture and they're putting it on their Instagram and they credit me. Like that's the normal way. Sometimes, you know, as a courtesy of given athletes pictures, and so they bought them. And when people ask them, oh, do you have any pictures of you? And they'll pass it along to a company or a podcast or something. They don't even think of it. And so it's like an honest mistake on their part. Usually when I see a company do it, I'll send them an email and go, hey, you know, like the athlete had that for personal use. If you want to use it for your commercial use, this is what the licensing fee is. And, you know, I don't come at companies from an adversarial relationship. I approach them nicely and go, hey, like that person didn't have rights to just pass it to you. If you want to use it for commercial, like, yeah, here's the fee. The ones that bug me when something gets screenshotted and then it's used to promote something, and I'll be like, hey, if you want to use it, this is the fee. And they'll be like, I'm just doing this for fun. This is my hobby. I'm not making anything out of it. And I'm always like in my head, well, that Macintosh computer that you use, or those microphones, or that video camera, was that you had paid for that. I'm like, the thing you're taking from me, like, I have an $8,000 camera and lens. You know, I drove 1,000 miles to shoot that. Like, that picture cost money. Like, I can't be altruistic and just, you know, it's just the cost of doing business. Like some people don't care because they're like, oh, I just want my name to get out there. But I feel like, you know, at a certain point, I have a mortgage, I have taxes, I have insurance, I have to eat, I have to travel to places. And you know, it's my full-time job. So, yeah, when people just screenshot stuff and then just think they're like, oh, but I gave him credit.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
so I'll just say, I think the big takeaway for everybody listening, right, mm-hmm. is that it's so easy, to your point, to go, oh, great picture, either share, screenshot, whatever. It might even be, love to run this race one day, kind of whatever. But just like with music, there's creative rights that go along with this stuff. And so when in doubt, you know, reach out, engage. And to your point, I mean, really, it shouldn't be a screenshot, right? It's so easy to do, but that really shouldn't be the way that we're doing that, right, without some kind of connection there saying, yes, please use it, especially if it looks professional.
So, yeah, so for me, that's what I wanted to talk about and have the conversation to talk about it, because I don't have this opportunity to learn from somebody. And I think for listeners and stuff who are involved, like, we're all entrenched in social media. We're all entrenched in this environment, right? And so it's, you know, symptomatic of the world that we live in and how it runs. And so, and to be able to hear it from your side, I think is very helpful, you know, for all of us. So I'm grateful.
I mean, I never would have understood it before I started doing it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of, like, when you're doing it as a freelancer full time, you don't want to just be flatline in your business. You want to grow it. You want to be able to buy different equipment. And it's just like any other job. It's no different than when I was a teacher or an engineer. It's like you provide a service and there's costs associated with it. And for all the people like that are like doing the things for enjoyment or where they're not doing it for income, you wouldn't go into the hardware store asking for a screwdriver for free just because you're building a cabinet for fun, right? So yeah. That's how it is for me. It's like, yeah, I have a service, I have a product, and you're hopefully paying for that person's eye and experience, and hopefully they're doing something you know that not other people can do.
There's not a lot of people can do what you do.
That's what I was say, and I think that's a great point to wrap up the discussion. But yeah, this discussion, I think, has been so eye-opening, not only about the photography and kind of the insight, you know, that we just got, which, by the way, I mean, I would say that the two things that really stood out to me is, one, how drawn you are to sentimental moments, emotions, those types of things. And then two, you even talk about being difficult on yourself, mm-hmm. right? I think that you put those two things together, and that's why we're seeing greatness come out of the other side of the camera and, you know, creating things that we will always remember and associate with kind of our ultra experience. So I really appreciate that about you. And just learning about your running journey and all the experience and incredible things. And it's been fun to watch you walk through those memories with us. So thank you so much for that.
The complete package.
And I'm sorry, my fault is I tend to ramble too much. So time gets burned real quick because I'm the worst at being, what was the term you used?
Sentimental.
Sentimental, yeah. I'm super sentimental. Yeah, and it just leads to more memories or whatever.
But that's been the goal.
Yeah.
For people to get to know you.
Yep.
And not just the product that you produce.
And look, this conversation, again, we've enjoyed so much. I'm going to talk to the listeners. We appreciate you all more than you know. And again, if you found the value, hopefully you just love this conversation. You find the value, share with your friends, do the like, do the subscribe, all that good stuff. Howie, our motto is just show up. And so that's usually what we try to leave the show with. And that is something, one, you show up as a runner, and we're looking forward to your race this year, as well as your other race, but you show up as a photographer. So thank you for that. Continue to do that. We're going to keep you around for the patrons and do a fun game. But for everybody else, we'll talk soon. Cut.
We just have this fancy background because it's actually just a big old piece of poster.
Oh, there you go.
It's not that big and fancy, but...
And it doesn't help being probably pretty ADHD, so my attention just gets diverted constantly.
That's perfect for us.
Yeah.
That is perfect. Number four, preferred mode of transportation.
If I could do anything, I'd be an F-16, but...
Yeah, see? Such a good answer.
I mean, we thought it was going to be like his feet. Well, next time you talk to Jim, just let him know I've got a 100-miler coming up. I'd love to have him pace me.
I will. Yeah, when you sent those questions along, I was like, oh, how can I type these out? I'm like, I can talk for hours on every single one. because there's just so much.
If I mess it up, just don't judge me, Howie. It happens every now and then. But the older I get, the harder it is for my brain to keep up with my eyes as I read the intro.
I understand that.
All right.
You're a child.
You know, you have this image of yourself, like you're out flying on the trails, you're doing all this cool stuff. And then you see a picture somebody took of you, like somewhere, and you're like, that's what I look like. Ugh.
Thank you so much, man.
All right. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Wonderful night.
See you.
Great to see you.
All right, listen, thank you so much. We recognize the fact that you are probably just hanging on just for a couple more minutes as you're finishing up your run. But really, we do want to give you a huge thank you for the constant support that you've shown us. We hear you and we feel you. And the best way for us to continue to grow is for you to share us with your friends. Tell them what you put in your ears when you're out there on a long run. Hit the like button, leave us a comment, leave a review, and give us some direct feedback on what you like about the show and also what you don't like. We're here to improve and do it for you.
And it really means the world. And listen, if you would like to support financially, you can connect with us on Patreon at patreon.com/theultrarunningguys, or you can use the support link in the show notes. Any and all support goes directly back into growing the show and helping us get better at what we love to do, which is to serve all of you. And with that, finish up that run, get cleaned up, and just show up.
Clean.
Clean.